In his obituary for Sir Peter Brook, Charles McNulty for the LA Times wrote, "Indeed, Brook lived and worked in a continual state of becoming. Even in his last decades, when he might have basked in the eminence of his international reputation, he was still experimenting, still trying to separate the essential from the meretricious." I absolutely love this quote. A continual state of becoming. That's exactly what I think of when I think of the titan of the last 70 years of world theater, Sir Peter Brook. Brook died this past summer. He passed on July 2nd, 2022, in his home in Paris. He was 97 years old. I gotta be honest, I've been dragging my feet putting together this particular podcast episode. I found out about Sir Peter's passing right over the 4th of July weekend. At the time, I felt like I had lost a beloved uncle that I hadn't seen in years. I felt this sense of grief. I struggled to come to terms with his passing. I mean, it wasn't unexpected. He was very, very old. On the other hand, Peter Brook, he always struck me as having this sort of immortal quality about him. Like, he was not merely a regular human being. He had these otherworldly eyes, and though they were diminished in his very last years, they still sparkled in this sort of uncanny way. This small gnome of a man struck me as both the most human person I have ever seen in my life, but also as someone kind of playing at and amused by being a human being. Let me be really clear right up at the front. I have never met Peter Brook. I never had a chance to meet him. But through his productions, his plays, and his writings about the theater, he has served as a sort of spiritual mentor for me as a theater maker, as a theater artist. Ever since I first came across him way back when I was an undergrad. Now, some great tributes for Brook showed up in the world's most prominent news publications this summer, though not enough for my taste. So I'm not going to recap the whole story of Peter Brook. Like, I'm not going to go over his entire biography. His accomplishments are so varied and, to some extent, so legendary that there's just too much. I mean, there's literally too much. It's his back catalog is vast. Some of his deeds in the theater are just, they're unbelievable, even today. I actually struggled with what I wanted to say about Sir Peter Brook. I mean, it's hard to put into words just how influential his work and his ethos have been on me. Some aspects of this are so ingrained in me all these years later that I think of them as second nature, not direct or even elliptical lessons passed on by this great man. I've just tucked them in to my own operating system. I'm also, to be clear, not an expert on Peter Brook. I mean, I'm very interested in him, but I'm not an expert, especially in any kind of academic sense. My interest in him is both practical and, to some degree, a little bit spiritual. I find reading about him and poring over his work comforting, especially when I'm stuck on something or I'm searching or I'm in need of inspiration. But Brook, as I said, is too big. He's too vast. He's just too much. After nearly three quarters of a century of very prolific output and layer upon layer of ideas, studying Brook is basically a bottomless well. And thankfully so. Part of the difficulty of celebrating Peter Brook is his own now legendary reluctance to be thought of as a guru in any sense. He waved off any such talk, proclaiming pretty definitively to anybody that would listen that he was not a model, he was not an example, and his work on stage was, at best, ethereal. It was meant to be experienced and then destined to be forgotten, just like the rest of theater. And if he didn't respond to the role of guru, he only begrudgingly even referred to himself as a director. He preferred the term distiller, somebody who boils away everything extraneous to render the essence of the story he's trying to tell. So here I am, trying to celebrate a man who adamantly would not have wanted to be celebrated. After getting over the initial news of his passing and then hemming and hawing about how I wanted to talk about him, I think I will go the course Peter Brook himself might have conceivably approved of. I will whittle it down to the most essential, the most simple connections. So what follows is a series of straightforward impressions, things that I have learned or that have stood out to me about Peter Brook, as I have discovered them over the years. Now, some of these things have influenced my work in the theater, and some of them have just straight out influenced me as a person. My name is Brad McIntyre. You are listening to the Cultivated Playwright Podcast. This is episode 35. Peter Brook started in the theater in a rather traditional way. As a young man in college in Oxford, he just wanted to be part of the entertainment business. He was originally drawn to film, but finding that the bar of entry was too high, he turned to theater, because he wanted to tell stories. But most of all, he wanted to work. When he was a young man, he just wanted to work. The theories and concepts he explored later in his life, this questioning of almost every aspect of a field of art, these were not yet there in his younger years. I mean, he could have been any one of us as a young, enthusiastic theater maker. This is the first thing that stands out about Brook to me, that he did not purposefully set out to be, quote-unquote, Sir Peter Brook, International Man of Theater. His ideas were formed organically over time. What he learned was hard won. Where he started as a very young man, a very young theater artist, was completely different than where he ended up. The most prominent feature about his early years to me was that he was just this really, really excited guy. He had this amazing excitement about what could be put on stage. I mean, the dude wished to know everything. The spirit of searching, of openness, of soaking up the world around him, this would take Peter Brook a long way. In his memoir, Threads of Time, which is a great book, by the way, I highly recommend it. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Brook recounts an encounter he had very early in his career. He had established himself as a director, and he was approached by a middle-aged architect who had been commissioned to design a new theater in a very small provincial town. Now, at this point, thrust stage configurations, they were called open stages at the time, like Tyrone Guthrie had created in Stratford, Ontario, those were in vogue at the time. The architect asked for advice, and a very confident young Peter Brook advised the man to dismiss an open stage, and instead, just go ahead and create a traditional proscenium arch style theater. See, at this time, Brook preferred the picture frame effect of the proscenium arch. To quote, "The so-called picture frame is an instrument of focus. It is foolish to throw it away. With an open stage, different parts of the audience see different things. But with a traditional picture frame, everyone sees the same stage picture." That's what he told the architect. I love this episode. It illustrates where Peter Brook came from and how far his thoughts and hard-tested theories on the theater experience had come. How they had changed over time. The mature, rather simplified, more austere Brook of later years, after decades of experiments, rightfully looked back with immense amusement at his younger self. So cocksure and less experienced, his philosophy on staging plays basically looped around 180 degrees. It went from thinking that the traditional proscenium arch stage picture, that's picture frame effect that you get from a proscenium arch theater, he went from that to doing plays, you know, out in front of mountains, in African villages, in his own theater in Paris, which has no platform whatsoever. It's just floor level with the audience kind of scattered around. It seems to be a lot of other examples of Brook's very paradoxical nature. His lifelong quest seemed to be to challenge the whole field of theater and boil it down to its most essential state. And he spent his whole career, his whole life kind of doing this. Anyway, I love that that he thought the Proscenium Arch Theater was the way to go. He advised the guy to make a theater like that because that's how tradition had always been done. That's what he grew up seeing. And boy, he moved away from that later on. Basically, he was saying, form your ideas and then hold them close, but hold them lightly and test them often. See, change is inevitable, he seemed to be saying. When I think of Brook, I see the director of the last several decades. This is the Peter Brook of my own lifetime. The impression I had of him, it showed the results of a lifetime of experiments, particularly during the last major phase of his very, very long career. See, I think of live music supplied from the side of the stage by one or two musicians, drums, always somebody playing the drums. I see carpets spread out on the floor to signify a playing space. Very little furniture, very little scenery. I see warm and earthy costumes that present both an ancient and a timeless impression. Like, they're made up of scarves and tunics and baggy pants and robes, and they represent no set nationality or style. I see actors that perform barefoot. I see performances of these actors being elegant and masterful and brimming with equal parts playfulness and power and especially clarity. I see audiences scattered about, nearly encompassing the stage. The front rows seated on padded floor cushions. Peter Brook seemed to like this a lot. I think in the very end of his time in his own theater in Paris, the fire marshal finally put a kibosh to this and wouldn't let people sit on the floor in front of the stage. But boy, he seemed to like having people sit on the floor, both the actors on stage and the audience members. And whereas we take for granted that the audience sits in darkness while the actors in the playing space are illuminated, in Brook's productions, the light that bathed the stage would sometimes spill out over the audience that shared that space. Now, personally, as a theater maker, I don't prefer all of Brook's kinds of staging. I don't try to emulate him, and I don't even really that much respond to some of the ways that he stages stuff. You see, I like a proscenium arch. Since I operate on a fringe indie level, I'm very often saddled with makeshift spaces and black box theaters set up with audiences on three sides, almost as a matter of course. The actor, often me, is almost always on floor level. The proscenium, with the audience all facing the same direction with decent sight lines, is actually a huge luxury. Anytime I get a chance to perform in a proscenium arch theater, I'm very grateful for it. It's not something that I take for granted. And you know what? I like the audience nestled in darkness. I don't like when people arbitrarily turn the lights up on both the audience and on the stage at the same time. I think it makes the audience particularly uncomfortable, especially if you're trying to do any kind of comedy. People do not laugh with the light on. But then again, I do a different kind of theater than Brook did. The important thing, the takeaway here, is that I see how he arrived where he did. I respect and appreciate how he got to where he did. He questioned everything, and then he ran it through the ringer. For years. The lesson of asking what is essential, what is really needed, is invaluable. In his highly influential 1968 book, The Empty Space, Brook encourages us, as theater makers, to be both simpler and more exacting in our work. He talked about how theater is as simple as an empty space in which something happens. The caveat being, you better really, really think about what happens in that space. And what really is needed. Especially for connection with your audience. The connection between the actors and the audience is paramount for Brook. Man, that was his go-to thing. Initially, when he was younger, Brook wanted to go into journalism. He wanted to be a foreign correspondent and live a life of travel and interaction, tasting of different cultures and lifestyles. He found, however, that theater offered a different sort of adventure, one that allowed glimpses into countless times and places and lives. So he threw himself into the theater, and as Brook plunged headlong into his work, he seemed to have a very amazing, like almost unbelievable knack for finding other capable folks to collaborate with. Like early on, in his very early 20s, he went to work for Barry Jackson. Barry Jackson brought Brooke along Jackson was already the director at the Birmingham Repertory Theater, and later he took charge of the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company. Barry Jackson described Brooke as a 20-year-old as the youngest earthquake I'd ever met. It's great. At the Royal Shakespeare Company, Brooke made waves, putting on stage. First, I believe he did a very hot and violent version of Romeo and Juliet, where traditionally it's been kind of romantic and sentimental. He also did a production of Love's Labor's Lost based on the paintings of Watteau. And it's during this period of time that he started working with a young actor named Paul Scofield. And the great Paul Scofield and Peter Brook went on to do some amazing projects together later in life, including a production of King Lear that they eventually put on film. Now, the bulk of the first few decades of Brook's career were filled with projects for the commercial stage. He did film and opera and subsidized theater. He played on Broadway. He worked at the RSC. He worked at the National Theater. He was celebrated for his Shakespeare productions. And in his early to mid-40s, Brooke started to grow restless. He had sort of a artistic midlife crisis, I guess. This sense of travel, of experimentation, and adventure seemed to call out to him. And in the late 1960s, after his experiments with Artaud's Theater of Cruelty, with his celebrated Asylum production of Marat Sade, after his astounding film version of King Lear with Scofield as the title role, after his production of Oedipus, Brooke came to a turning point, both in his life and his career. By 1968, the year that he published The Empty Space, Brooke's second child, Simon, had been born. And his wife, Natasha Perry, announced to him that she aimed to return to being a professional actor on the stage after taking several years off for maternity and domesticity. Their first child, by the way, Irina, had been born in 1962. Now, like a lot of us, reaching the beginning of middle age and coming to terms with the sacrifices of parenthood, Brooke realized, boy howdy, a change was needed. He needed a new location, a new home base, where he could finally put down some roots. He also needed a new direction to go, one that didn't abandon the work that he had done before, you know, all the stuff he'd done up to this point, but somehow expanded it, that furthered it. I relate with this point in Brooke's life, since it is roughly where I am in my own life and career right now. I'm a little bit more of a late bloomer than Brooke. Of course, I also work on a much smaller scale, way smaller scale than the international kind of platform that he worked on. But as anyone who's listened to this podcast for any length of time, especially the earlier episodes, will know by now that I am a father. Now, like deep into my 40s, I've become somebody's dad. And after nearly 30 years of continually learning and practicing my craft, I can empathize with this question that Brooke came up against. What now? Because one doesn't want to throw away all the stuff that's come before, but that old drive has changed. There's this sense that one must finally, I don't know, grow up. Like, after years and years of messing around, and in Brooke's case, experimenting, you kind of ask yourself, well, now what? I was interviewed on Holly Bagwell's podcast, Give Me 20, about this time last year. One of her questions that she asked me was about how I have changed as a theater maker since my younger days. And I replied that there was a long period of me trying to prove myself when I was younger, of spreading the net wide and tackling things for the sake of experience. But now, as I enter my middle years of what I optimistically hope will be a very long career, I find myself not trying to prove anything to anyone. I mean, not anymore. Now I'm simply trying to improve. I'm trying to be a better version of the artist I have evolved into. This improve instead of prove mentality is what I think Brooke would have keyed into as well. See, he began to conceive an altogether different project in his mid-40s. Now, Brooke had spent years avoiding running his own theater, but he was finally coming around. He wrote in a letter to a friend, "I have never wanted the tie and the responsibility of a theater of my own. Now, and only gradually at that, I'm beginning to prepare for the need of having a group for which I can be totally responsible on all levels for a substantial period of time. It now seems to me that this is the only possible evolution after so many years of attempts and experiments." So by 1970, he and his family had relocated from England to Paris, France. The goal at the time was to bring together an international group of well-trained actors, down for experimentation and adventure. He had classically trained actors from France, actors steeped in ritual from Africa, English Shakespeareans, actors from Japan, and of course, American actors, kind of hippie method actors. Everyone brought to the table a different toolkit of techniques and training. And as soon as Brooke had them all together, instead of having each of them teach the others, he had each actor basically abandon the training that they had acquired up to that point. Everything was stripped back to the very essential. What qualities do these actors share that make them human? Brooke was interested in exploring what makes us similar, what connects us as humans, rather than how are we different. The group trained together, inventing from scratch, really, under Brooke's leadership, new exercises and new techniques. They experimented with elemental rhythms, a full range of physical movements, and the most basic human motivations and interactions. And the group of folks that he surrounded himself with at this time, oh man, it was like no joke. These were some heavy hitters. There was the very young Helen Mirren, and she was, you know, up for anything. A very youthful Bruce Meyer, who would stick with Brooke for years. Excellent actor. His powerhouse actress wife, of course, Natasha Perry. One of the main collaborators at the time was a young man from Japan named Yoshi Oida. Oida has, over the years, become a major influence on me as well. Oida stayed with Brooke since he first came to his company in 1970, not being able to speak English or French, and he basically communicated by bowing and smiling. Oida, even in his older years, he sort of blends this childlike enthusiasm and wonder and excitement, even a sense of fun for performing, with a very rigorous sense of discipline and craftsmanship. Back in 2011, I had a privilege of seeing both Oida and Bruce Myers together on stage with the wonderful actress Hayley Carmichael. The trio of them were in a play at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. They were performing 5 short Beckett pieces that collectively were put together in an evening called Fragments. It was co-directed by Brooke and his partner in art, Marie-Hélène Estienne. I hope I said her name correctly. She'll come up again here in a second. What I remember most about the production was this amazing sense of playfulness this group had. I mean, they're all older actors, and they're doing Beckett. And playfulness is not something that you see a lot when you think of, like, Samuel Beckett's works. I mean, Samuel Beckett's works are playful to some degree, but that's not the descriptor that stands out the most when you think about Samuel Beckett. But that's what I remember the most from this production of Fragments. Yeah, Oida, it was amazing. In fact, Brooke recounts one story about how the company was invited to a rather boring presentation one time, like in the early 70s. And Oida was sitting on the front row, just down from Brooke. And everyone kind of squirmed and glanced for the exit, and they were patiently waiting for this very tedious presentation to end, you know, so they wouldn't offend their hosts. And just a little bit into the presentation, Brooke glanced down the row, and he noticed that Oida had somehow slipped away. Like, from the front row. He had just left. Like, without anybody noticing, he just kind of like disappeared. Brooke recounts his story with amusement and reverence for his friend. Now, if there's a person that I would like to be to get out of meetings, it is Ouida. Like, that's an amazing skill, to slip away unseen from the front row. This is an example of something that Brooke seems to put a great deal of stock into, and I would admit I do as well. And that is, it's often just a matter of letting actions speak louder than words. Like, behavior and actions go a long, long way, both on stage and as a person. I have my own Ouida, by the way. I don't know if I've mentioned him very often here in this podcast, but I'm going to do so right now. For the past 20 years or so, I've collaborated with my friend Jeff Swearingen. Jeff and I met a few years after I got out of college, and he was just sticking his toe into acting, just starting to work on the stage. We were both in a children's theater company together, doing plays like, The Velveteen Rabbit and Winnie the Pooh and stuff like that for little kids, Frog and Toad. Anyway, I've directed him dozens of times over the years, and he went on eventually to start his own theater company at one point for a few years. And he branched out from acting and he started directing and playwriting as well. We've performed long-form improv together for, I don't know, a decade and a half at least by now. Like Ouida's daring and mischievousness to Brooke's steady concentration, Swearingen's qualities seem to complement my own. We push each other and we support each other. And like Brooke, I think partnerships such as this really are valuable. Like, they allow for artistic growth. And I'm grateful to have my kind of partner in art, Jeff Swearingen. He is my Yoshi Ouida. Brooke was very open to great artistic influence. He borrowed a lot of his ideas from his avant-garde contemporaries, Grotowski and Artaud and Brecht and Meyerhold, Joan Littlewood. Edward Gordon Craig was big in his book. Now, what set him apart was he actually put the theories of these folks into practice on the stage. He did this through experimenting with the very nature of theater. In fact, Brooke seemed comfortable with simply trying a bunch of stuff out. He was very good at just throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall and just seeing what stuck. This spirit of experimentation so appealed to me that I ended up naming my own small theater company, Audacity Theater Lab. I feel that too much focus on the resulting production implies bringing something to market. It is commercial in its approach to some extent, to focus on the end result, to focus on the production. But I like process. Brooke loved the process. His theater was a laboratory. One great example of this was his trip through Africa with his international troupe of artist adventurers in the early 1970s. Brooke founded the International Center for Theater Research in Paris in 1970. It's the CIRT is the French acronym for it. He gathered a group of international actors. These folks were all young, adventurous, and, as I said before, very well trained in their respective cultural performance practices. He brought this group together, and then he asked them to divulge themselves from their own backgrounds. He was interested in what made these actors alike, not what made them different. What human qualities did they share, and then what universal human stories and situations would develop? He took these actors on a tour through Africa. In fact, they went to Persia, and then they went to the United States a little bit after that before they eventually came back to Paris. But when they were in Africa, they would stop in a small village, and Brooke, through a translator, would explain to the village leaders what they were attempting to do, to see on what basis we, as people, might relate with one another. And then the troupe would unfurl a large carpet on the dirt ground, as a playing space. Villagers would gather around the actors, and then somebody would begin an improvisation. For instance, somebody might toss a shoe onto the carpet, and then another actor would approach cautiously, poke at it, pick it up, and then hug the shoe against her chest, an additional actor might enter and then take the shoe, a chase ensues, basically an improvisational story emerges. And the whole performance was done with sound effects and really broad physicality. No words, no dialogue. And they did this over and over and over again, seldom duplicating the exact same format, the exact same show, and incorporating the audience each and every time. It was amazingly playful and brave and communicative. Ironically, I've miscommunicated the word communicative. Communicative. There was a great deal of, there was a lot of communication. That's what I'm saying. This is especially true considering everybody seemed to speak a different language or a different dialect. I first learned about Peter Brook when I was in college. I was in a theater history class, and we all had to do projects on important theater artists from the last 200 years, and a friend of mine did one on Brook. I actually can't remember who I did for that project, but boy, I remember this guy's presentation. It was the first time that I had heard about Peter Brook, to tell the truth, and one of the first projects that this guy brought up was this African tour, and it caught my attention, and it just bowled me over with just how awesome it sounded. It appeals to me even today on so many levels, like personal levels for stuff that I do, like improv and clowning, simplifying, directness. I mean, just the adventure of caravanning around in jeeps through the backcountry, camping out every night, going to all these little African villages, taking theater performance to strangers, basically, in places where they might not even have a word for the concept of theater. This was a pilgrimage, basically, to answer the question, what were the common stories, the recognizable shorthands, the instant abstractions, the shared outlines of story and character with which an international group could work? They experimented with gesture and sound and narrative. Of course, for Brooke and the company, this excursion was simply a stepping stone to further experiments and explorations. He and the core of his international group went on to a home base in 1974. They moved into a derelict Parisian music hall called the Bouffe du Nord. He did this, I might add, with the help of his Parisian agent, manager, and producer, Micheline Rosen. Or Rosen. I've never heard her name said out loud. Anyway, she was instrumental in helping him find funding for his adventures and experiments, as well as leading him to the Bouffe du Nord to begin with. I should segue here. Brooke seems to have been blessed with some amazing female collaborators through his life. They just kind of happened over and over again. I mean, his wife, Natasha Perry, was a huge influence on him, but also Micheline Rosen and Marie-Hélène Estienne. These people kind of came up in waves throughout his life and really supported him and helped him grow as an artist. Anyway, back to the Bouffe du Nord. When they found it in 1974, they cleaned it out and they made it safe, but they did not overhaul the space. The proscenium arch itself remained, but the stage beneath it was torn out. It was busted up. So shows ended up happening on the floor. The auditorium was still tiered in a half circle, but the seats for the audience were replaced with benches, and places were left, of course, on the floor for seat cushions right in the front. Renovations left the weathered, textured walls. I mean, they were cleaned, but they were not repaired. The age and the wear, the splendid ruin of it, was left on display. From the early 1970s onward, marked a very fruitful and prolific period for Peter Brook and his troupe. There was the seminal White Box Midsummer Night's Dream that they did. There's been a lot written about that. There was the epic version of the Mahabharata, the ancient Indian Sanskrit classic of gods and battles and princes that they did back in the mid-80s. In the early 2000s, he presented The Tragedy of Hamlet with Adrian Lester in the title role. Brook approached Hamlet as if it were a brand new play that he just plucked out of a script pile. Like he purposefully ignored the 400 years of baggage that the play has acquired. This original approach yielded a tight, like just over 2-hour amazingly straightforward version of Hamlet. In fact, I've watched it on video, I don't know, maybe half a dozen times. If there's one descriptor of this production that stands out, it is clarity. Not everything is puppies and rainbows in Peter Brook's past. For instance, he caught a little bit of flack over the years for accusations of cultural appropriation and post-colonialism. His Mahabharata, for example, had a multinational cast made up of lots of ethnicities and skin tones. Brook thought of the Mahabharata as a world text, like the Bible or the works of Shakespeare, with something universal to say about humanity. But this rationalization did not go over so well for some people in India, who, you know, of course felt some ownership over the Mahabharata. On the other hand, it can be argued Brook was a pioneer of what is typically called nowadays colorblind casting, though he does not respond well to that phrase. When he was asked about colorblind casting, Brook invariably, in any interview that he's in, corrects the statement, and he says it should be called color-rich, or even color-welcome casting. In a podcast interview with Barbara Bogave a couple of years ago, he said, "Colorblind implies something snobbish, that we have our eyes closed and can't bring ourselves to look. On the contrary, we should have our eyes wide open, welcoming the fact that this actor might be light brown, and that other a little bit dark brown, and that other person, that other poor actor over there, white." He goes on to say, "I don't like grand terms, such as artistic vision, because I don't believe I have one." This was in an interview for the London Guardian back in 2005. "For me," he said, "the absolute necessity was to work with actors of different cultures and backgrounds, and play our productions in front of different audiences." Brook continued to work into his mid-90s. As I said, he passed on when he was 97, and he was doing theater up until he was 95 years old. Two of his final offerings, I think, are apt to bring up here. And I should say, I've read one of these plays, but not both of them. And I've just read about them. I'm going to describe them here because I think they have something to say about Peter Brook himself. In 2016, Brook, with his frequent collaborator since the 80s, Marie-Hélène Estienne, and the writer Jean-Claude Carrière, it was the guy that originally wrote the adaptation of the Mahabharata back in the 80s. Anyway, they produced a play called Battlefield, and this was a sequel to the Mahabharata. The Mahabharata, by the way, I keep saying it, the Mahabharata is a tale which encompasses hundreds of smaller tales, including, probably most famously, the Bhagavad Gita. It's a tale of war between 100 sons of a blind king and then the 5 sons of his brother. And in this tale, every effort's made to avoid war. I mean, the gods show up and they give kind of inscrutable advice, like good advice. But fate, of course, cannot be avoided, and there's this epic war, and this epic bloodshed ends with brother killing brother, cousin killing cousin, and hundreds of thousands and thousands of people lay dead. The play Battlefield picks up as sort of an epilogue, like about the aftermath of this epic war. It opens with the victor of it kind of looking over in horror and basically unable to face the consequences of his actions. Just the horror of looking at the battlefield itself and like just seeing what he's done. And his only desire is to leave the world and live in the woods as a hermit. This play, which is just over an hour, which I should say is highly in contrast to the 9-hour staging of the Mahabharata when it went up in 1985. Anyway, Battlefield is a concentrated exploration of the ethics of responsibility, of following one's destiny, and trying to make the best of it. The other production I kind of want to touch on here at the end of his career is, in 2019, he and SDN co-wrote and co-directed a play called Why? With a question mark at the end. The piece is kind of part lecture, part demonstration, and part mediation on the purpose, as well as the dangers of theater. The first act being a sort of inside baseball glimpse at theater makers' thoughts on the nature of theater itself, and then a second act that serves as a sort of biographical study of Meyerhold. Meyerhold was a Russian director and a student of Stanislavski who broke away from his teacher's ideas and concepts to come up with his own. And his own ideas were pretty innovative and, I should note right here, very influential on Peter Brook. Now, Meyerhold's search for truth made him a political target when Stalin came to power in Russia. And Meyerhold was imprisoned and then tortured and eventually executed. His art made Meyerhold dangerous. Now, Brook's production, so from all descriptions I've read, this does not sound exactly like a straightforward play in the traditional sense. But it did seem to be this piece that directly asked the questions that Meyerhold himself was asking in the early 1900s. Why do we do theater? Why do we give our lives to this art form? Let me end today with a word about Brook's most influential book, The Empty Space. I'm sure this is a text that most theater artists have read. If you're any kind of theater nerd, you have picked up The Empty Space at some point, and it has been highly influential on so many people, and me included. I consider it like basically my theater Bible in some way. In this very short volume, Brook covers four different kinds of theater that he was observing during the middle of the 20th century. Deadly theater is what he called this very well-groomed but toothless way of putting on productions of old plays, and they were presented in the same ways that they had always been done. This sort of theater doesn't necessarily have anything important to say, even if it's very nice to look at, like the production values are good. A lot of the commercial theater at the time, from the what Brook had seen from the late 40s through the 50s and early 60s, this is the label that Brook used for these kinds of plays. He called them deadly theater. Holy theater is high-minded theater that strives to say something really significant, but is very short on engaging the audience. It's theater that takes itself really, really seriously, probably too seriously, but it does not make itself accessible to the audience. The third kind of theater he touched on we called rough theater. This is the label that Brook gave to stuff like melodrama and vaudeville and music hall. This is theater that's really enjoyable and really entertaining, but it doesn't necessarily have anything, you know, hugely important or significant to say. Like, that's not the goal of it. And the last type of theater that Brook mentions is the immediate theater. The theater that asserts itself in the present. Immediate theater occurs when the audience is reacting to what is happening on the stage in real time. What is happening is both intellectually and emotionally elevating. When I imagine these types of theaters in a graph, I picture a triangle with the extremes of deadly, holy, and rough at the corners, and immediate theater right smack in the middle, balanced and equal distance from each of the others, like a sweet spot to shoot for. Immediate theater has elements of the other three, but with the measurements just right. Upon reading The Empty Space right after college, I knew I had found some sort of North Star to navigate by. Immediate is the sort of theater that I strive to make today, that I've been striving to make most of my career in the theater. Not just in how I create the plays, like through the scripts, like through the plays, like through play writing, but also in how I produce them on the stage. This is the opening sentence to The Empty Space. It's like super famous, and you've probably heard it before. I still use this little bit at the beginning of The Empty Space as the definition for the act of theater when I teach college classes. So, I mean, I used it earlier this semester when I was teaching a class. It is basically the Kool-Aid concentrate form of what makes the act of theater happen. Brook writes, "I can take an empty space and call it a bare stage. A man walks across the empty space while someone else is watching him, and this is all that is needed for an act of theater to be engaged." Thank you for this, Sir Peter Brook. An actor, an audience, and a place for both of these parties to gather. I mean, that sums it up. This is where we start. Hey, thanks for listening. Once again, my name is Brad McIntyre. I hope you've enjoyed this this kind of memorial look back at Peter Brook. He has definitely been majorly influential on me in so many ways, and the world will miss him dearly. But he has left behind so much for us to go over and to plow through and to inspire our own work. Just an amazing individual, and to show what is possible. Like what can this art form do? Like, somebody, you know, seriously went and took it out on a test drive. I highly recommend you look at his book, The Empty Space. If you have never looked at it before and you're in the theater, it's time to catch up. There's also some really other good books. He has a book called The Shifting Point, which kind of talks about acting and collaborating. He's got a book on Shakespeare, The Quality of Mercy, which he basically obliterates the whole notion that people believe that somebody besides Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare's plays. And, oh, his memoir is great too, Threads of Time. I'll put a link to these in the show description on the website, which is, by the way, the Cultivated Playwright, or cultivatedplaywright.wordpress.com. That's the website for the podcast. Anyway, I appreciate you listening. Until next time, have a great day, and go out and do great things. Bye-bye.